If you've ever wondered why Amazing Grace is the national anthem of funerals, or pondered the state of your eternal soul after you die, the Lutheran Witness has got you covered. Check out the June-July issue of The Lutheran Witness to learn more about death, dying, heaven, and hell. Not a subscriber? Visit cph.org/trylutheranwitness for a special offer. $6.99 for 6 digital or print issues. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. The headline reads, Newly Discovered Manuscript and Its Lesson on Islam. Early drafts of a canonical work show how Muslims' understanding of their faith has evolved. Now, I wonder, in a Muslim country, is the average Muslim taught that their faith is ever evolving, that the teachings of Islam have changed in the past and might change in the future, and that the interpretation is ever changing? I doubt it. Well, what does this newly discovered manuscript of a commentary on Islamic text tell us about the Islamic faith, both past and present? Joining us to discuss the discovery of an Islamic manuscript and reform in Islam, Dr. Adam Francisco, Associate Professor of History and Political Thought at Concordia University, Irvine, California. He's author of the book Martin Luther and Islam. Adam, welcome back.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Laying aside for a moment kind of westernized Islam, in the average Islamic country, do you think that the average Muslim is taught that his religion is not tied firmly to a single book like the Quran, or that that interpretation of that book has changed over time?
No. At least the core of Islam, and certainly the doctrine in the Quran, not only are they taught that remains the same, but it's static, that when the Quran is recited or read and studied, it's as if you're reading or reciting or understanding God's eternal speech. And to suggest you can change it by opinion or popular vote or whatever is an affront to Islam. It's seen as setting up human opinion over and against God's authority, and therefore is a form of what Muslims call shirk, which is the one unforgivable sin.
Okay, so what was discovered here that this article writes about, and what does it mean for our understanding of Islam today?
Well, so it's a text written in the late 14th, early 15th century by a pretty well-known Sunni, that is traditionalist Muslim scholar named Ibn Hajar. And what it is a commentary on what are called the Hadith. And the Hadith are basically, there's multiple collections of Hadith, and these are basically anecdotes that are alleged to be traced back to Muhammad. Things he said when he was asked a question, or things he did in particular circumstances that weren't recorded in the Quran because they weren't direct revelation from Allah, but because Muhammad is, in at least in the Muslim view, the perfect man, even his actions are in a sense inspired. So the Hadith are second only to the Quran, and in some ways the Hadith are kind of have an instrumental authority over the Quran, and that the Hadith will be looked at almost like a lens through which you can interpret chronologically the text of the Quran. So the Hadith are a big deal. They are the second source for Islamic law and practice. This text that was discovered is a commentary on the Hadith, and what the author of the Atlantic article alleges is that because this book was written over the course of over two decades, and because the author changed his mind on things, that suggests that all of Islam can change. And it is true that there are, when it comes to gray areas or things that are not covered in the Quranic text or are not clear in the Hadith, you can have multiple opinions on certain questions on those matters. But when things are clear in the Quran, certainly, and even the Hadith, at least the authoritative collections, the case is settled. There's even a hadith that has Muhammad saying that every innovation is a heresy and every heresy is a sin. So traditionally, historically, Muslims, Sunni Islam, which is 85 to 90% of the Muslim world, they have been opposed to any sort of innovation or what they call bid'ah.
So, can you fit this within the context of the various sects or branches of Islam?
Yeah. Well, so the text itself that was discovered is Sunni, and it's sort of like premier Sunni literature. It's the equivalent. Ibn Hajar is the equivalent for Catholics as Thomas Aquinas or for Lutherans Martin Luther, if you will. A pretty solid authority. And the text itself is, I'm not sure how many volumes it takes up because there's multiple editions of it, but it's huge. We're talking 20 plus volumes. And it is one of the go-to sources for the understanding of the Hadith and Islamic law. And, and for that reason, you go to any, I think the article even points this out, you go to any well-stocked Islamic library or bookstore, it's going to be featured front and center. The Shia, though, who make up 15 to 10% of the Muslim world, there's so much, historically speaking, animosity between the Sunni and the Shia. And they don't look like huge differences, but to Sunnis and Shia, the differences in theology and ethics and just the understanding of what Islam is different, markedly different between the two camps. For Shia, Islam, the core of Islam, the essence of Islam, if you will, does not change, but Islam can be added to as time moves forward. So it's kind of interesting that this article claims that the Sunni author proves that traditional or mainstream Islam is open to all sorts of innovation. That is not the case at all. But within Shiism, it is kind of the case that Islam can be added to.
So one of those branches would hold open a possibility of new revelation. The other wouldn't.
Yes. Yeah, I probably should have added a bit more. So the two, there's a lot of differences between the two, but Sunni basically means a traditionalist. And the basic posture of Sunni Islam is that the teachings of Islam, not just theology, but also law and everything else, it's pretty much a closed canon. That the Sunni is mostly, at least historically, has been mostly interested in preserving and perpetuating the teachings of the Quran and the traditions of Muhammad. The Shia are argued right from the get-go that because Islam is destined to expand, that Muslims are under orders from Muhammad and ultimately by God to expand the reach of Islam geopolitically, Islam and the Islamic State will always face new questions when it encounters new cultures and questions that Muhammad never had to address. And when those questions come up, the Shia say there are certain people who are connected to Muhammad by bloodline. Today it's the Ayatollahs. In the past it was the Imams. They have there's a charisma in their blood that helps them divine God's will. Even though there may not be a text to support it. It sort of parallels, I don't want to pick on the Catholics here, but it does kind of parallel the sort of two streams of authority in traditional Catholicism, where you have the biblical revelation, then you have the revelation through the tradition of the papacy, and that that evolves over time.
And that further revelation might build upon the previous or add to it, but would never contradict, say, something in the Quran or the Hadith.
Absolutely. A couple of examples would be the Quran in one passage says that a man can, so long as he can afford it, have up to four wives. And so in Muslim countries, Sunni or Shia Muslim countries, as women's rights and feminism and things like that continue to advance slowly but surely in many Muslim-majority countries, there's been a lot of pressure on the part or by these progressive movements to abolish polygamy. And the response from the Islamic establishment is, you can't do that because God has established once and for all that men can have up to four wives. So, and in fact, you know, groups like Al-Qaeda or ISIS or even the Muslim Brotherhood would say that to open up some sort of referendum where people can vote on matters that the Quran has actually, the Quran actually has a position on, is like the biggest affront to God, because you're putting human beings, or you're giving them as much authority as God himself. And in Islam, only God has the right to make law.
Dr. Adam Francisco is our guest. He'll be with us for another 10 minutes or so on the other side of the break, leading us up to the top of the hour. We are talking about a discovery of an Islamic manuscript and reform in Islam, the subject of a article in The Atlantic, a newly discovered manuscript and its lesson on Islam. We'll talk about reform in Islam after this.
If you've ever wondered why Amazing Grace is the national anthem of funerals, or pondered the state of your eternal soul after you die, the Lutheran Witness has got you covered. Check out the June-July issue of the Lutheran Witness to learn more about death, dying, heaven, and hell. Not a subscriber? Visit cph.org/trylutheranwitness for a special offer, $6.99 for 6 digital or print issues. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective.
Memoria Press invites all Issues Etc. listeners to explore our Simply Classical curriculum, a set of full-year academic curriculum packages for children with learning challenges. Our classical writing program and our Christian studies are now based on your favorite CPH Bible storybooks. To learn more, visit classicalspecialneeds.com and use promo code LPR to save on your initial purchase. That's classicalspecialneeds.com.
Providing artillery support for the church militant on the front lines, you're listening to Issues Etc.
The church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century.
O come, O come, Emmanuel.
The 16th century. The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Adam Francisco is our guest. We're talking about an article in The Atlantic on the discovery of an Islamic manuscript and reform in Islam. Let's talk about that idea of reform, especially during this 500th anniversary of the Lutheran Reformation. It is largely viewed as a good thing in Christianity. I think even the Roman Catholic Church has come around to a certain idea about reform, not the Reformation, but about reform, where they view it as a positive thing. What would reform look like if it followed the pattern of the Christian Reformation going back to the original sources? What would that look like in Islam, Dr. Francisco?
Well, it would be problematic. You'd see more things like the Islamic State emerge, probably. But I should add, on the other hand, there are certain groups, especially here in the West, in America and Western Europe, the Muslims who are reformist-type Muslims, some of them have been even called the Martin Luthers of Islam, if you will, like Tariq Ramadan was some years ago. And they have they're trying to articulate Islam for the 21st century by going back at fontes or to the source, like the Protestant reformers did. But they're going back to the original source and only to the Quran. And there, many of them are questioning, if not outright rejecting, all the traditional material that interprets the Quranic text. And there's a scholar out of University of Virginia, or retired now, but named Abdulaziz Sajidina, and he actually put forward what he called Islamic theology for the 21st century that deconstructs 1,400 years of Islamic thought, and in its place reconstructs from the Quranic text, cherry-picking certain passages, a new, kinder, gentler form of Islam. So, I mean, just to be fair, if they did have a Reformation, it was going back to the sources, plural, Quran and Hadith, you would have more what we typically call radical Islamic stuff or Islamism. But there are some Muslims who are kind of pushing in a different trajectory. Go ahead.
Well, just to make a point, or to pause at that point for a second, it would not look like people sometimes talk about reform in Islam, and they mean it kind of becoming kinder and gentler. You're saying real kind of back to the sources kind of reform in Islam wouldn't render a kinder and gentler Islam.
Correct. Yeah. Or at least we should not bank on that. An article in National Review years ago asked that very question. Should Westerners encourage and support these attempts at reform in Islam in the hopes that it will, bring about this kinder or passive form of Islam? And the author said, no, because once they go back to their sources, they'll realize that all this sort of the liberal Islam actually doesn't square up or correspond to those texts. And then we'll see a resurgence of Islamism yet again. Now, to be fair, there are lots of, Islam is, and historically has been, rather diverse. There are so many different movements out there that all don the mantle of being Islamic. And kind of like, sort of parallel to Christianity, they come up with all sorts of, depending on what their priorities are in terms of authority, whether it's a text or reason or culture or what have you, they come up with different conclusions to just what Islam is. And there really is a war of ideas going on within Islam itself. It's really quite interesting. And I would say when it comes to this discussion about Islam being reformed, if there's some sort of something that, like the Enlightenment that happened to Islam, that would be, at least from our perspective, a good thing, because it would really call into question the authority of the Quranic text, and certainly would inject in Islam a certain dose of skepticism that might be helpful in the left hand or the kingdom or the civil realm.
So, with only about a minute before we take our next break, you're saying there that if a little touch of the Enlightenment were to infect Islam, they might actually question the veracity of the Quran?
Well, there are Muslims who call themselves Muslims who are in fact atheists, and who are trying to spark a kind of an Enlightenment, where reason will be placed over revelation in terms of how one understands a text. And I think I don't think the Enlightenment was a good thing for Christianity at all, but I think it'd be a good thing from our perspective for Islam, because it could at least legitimize some sort of skepticism or critical reflection within the Islamic world. I wouldn't bet on it, but it could work that way.
Dr. Adam Francisco is our guest. He'll be with us for a few minutes on the other side of the break on this Friday, June the 30th. He's Associate Professor of History and Political Thought at Concordia University, Irvine, California. He's author of the book Martin Luther and Islam. In hour two of Issues Etc., after a few minutes with Dr. Francisco, Pastor Peter Burfind will be our guest. We're going to talk about two issues. One, what he's calling irreligious violence. That is, violence that is not based in religion, but based in irreligion, both on the left and the right in America. We usually focus on the violence that has its origin in the irreligious left, but he says, well, the irreligious left no longer faces a passive Christianity, but an irreligious right. We'll also talk about millennials and Vacation Bible School. Then we'll play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week.
Theology for Blue Collar, White Collar, and Clerical Collar. You're listening to Issues Etc.
St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Wildwood, Missouri is a proud sponsor of Issues Etc. And if you enjoy the relevant, Christ-centered teachings presented on this program, then you should come and join us at St. Paul's on Sundays at 9 a.m., where you will hear sermons that proclaim Jesus Christ and Him crucified for our sins, and enjoy in-depth Bible studies to help us grow as disciples. For more information, check us out at stpaullutheranwildwood.org.
Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois, engages young adults in a Christ-centered environment, delivering academic excellence and spiritual growth to develop Christian leaders for tomorrow. We provide a Christ-focused alternative to public high schools. Many of our students receive tuition assistance. To help us provide tuition assistance to more students, go to melhs.org and click on the giving page, or call me, Dr. J. Krause, principal, at 618-656-0043.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Adam Francisco is our guest. We're talking about the discovery of an Islamic manuscript and reform in Islam. The Issues Etc. book of the month for June is Will the Real Jesus Please Stand Up? 12 False Christs. One of the Christs listed in that book is just Christ the Good Teacher, which is essentially where Islam usually categorizes Jesus. Good teacher, prophet, and he has some apocalyptic roles to play, but more or less we're talking about just a good teacher, if, of course, in Islam you ignore most of what he said and claimed in the New Testament. It's just one of the false Christs you'll read about in the Issues Etc. book of the month for June, Will the Real Jesus Please Stand Up? By Dr. Matt Richard. It's at our website on every page, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Dr. Francisco, I want to talk about westernized Islam. I don't think it can be isolated from kind of the true believerism Islam that's predominant in the rest of the world. But if it could be, Islam seems to be, at least theologically, somewhat neutralized in the United States. Is there an effect that maybe, as you were saying before the break, the Enlightenment, the prosperity of Western civilization, living where you see kind of the benefits of Christian capital in terms of its ideology, that has, at least from our perspective, a mitigating effect on the worst things Islam could offer?
Yeah, I think that is very much the case. You know, if you spend, I don't normally hang out or at mosques, but, I'll bring student groups to them just to see what Muslims do there and whatnot. And I've heard plenty sermons on Friday at Friday prayers where the imam, who's an otherwise conservative theologically, is much more moderate socially, politically, than he probably would be if he was living in Egypt or Baghdad or wherever. And the question you ask is kind of $1 million question. Is it a result of American culture and all the conveniences we have that kind of force them to that sort of moderate position, or is it just sort of a temporary position they're adopting till maybe the number of Muslims becomes higher here in the U.S.? That's another question people wonder about. So, but I do think in America, and there's plenty of scholars who have noted this, sociologists, anthropologists, and others, that Muslims in America tend to, when you compare them to like British Muslims or French Muslims, tend to assimilate in America more than anywhere else. And by that, we mean culturally assimilate. That doesn't mean they give up their theology, but everything else becomes Americanized. In fact, they even have a term for it. There's a scholar out of a seminary in Connecticut, Hartford Seminary, which is now used to be a Christian seminary. Now I think they call themselves a seminary for the Abrahamic faiths or something. But he once wrote me an email. I knew him back from England, and he said that he was enjoying his time in America being Mongolized. And that's a historic reference to when the Islamic Empire of the Middle Ages, the Abbasid Empire, was taken over by the Mongols, and sort of a Islam was watered down, not theologically, but culturally in terms of its law and politics. And so they've kind of, I sometimes wonder if they've just sort of are buying their time till circumstances maybe will change, and then they'll have more of a say politically, if you will. And then maybe we'll see a return of a conservative form of Islam. But where that all comes from, I'm sure it's different for every Muslim, but I do think that America, or security in America, that the liberties we have, the opportunities and so on, I think must play some role in pacifying Islam and its assertiveness in the civil realm.
I'm certain there are Muslims living in America, assimilated into American society and beliefs and ideals, who fall into that category, Dr. Francisco, of saying, well, you know, in a purer world, I'd be able to live under Sharia law, but they may not really realize what it is. It's hard for me, though, to imagine kind of the average physician who's a Muslim, you know, living out in Berkeley or someplace, saying, boy, I'd really rather be in Iran right now, living under Sharia law. I'd really rather live in Saudi Arabia and live under Sharia law. It's hard for me to imagine that.
Yeah, isn't it interesting? It's interesting that so many Muslims, when they come to the U.S. or to Western Europe, they the ones who get all upset about how liberal Western Europe or America might be, yet if you were to ask them, well, why did you come? Well, they didn't want anything to do with what's going on in their home country, you know? So it's almost like their understanding of Sharia is kind of an abstract understanding. They think, because, I mean, Islam teaches if you abide by the Sharia to the T, you know, then you will have peace. You know, Sharia is in classical Arabic refers to a path to the watering hole being a metaphor for paradise. And so I wonder if that, you know, they have this abstract understanding, they don't understand all the pieces and parts or the details. And then when all of a sudden they do, they run from it. And you see this in Egypt back in, I think it was 2011, when Mohamed Morsi was elected as president. He was not only was he a professor here in California of engineering, I think, he was a full-blown member of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is an Islamist organization that is primarily interested in, at least their slogan used to say, in treating the Quran as their constitution. When he took office in 2011, he was advised by some Sunni clerics that the people in Egypt voted him into office fair and square because they want Egypt to become more of a Muslim country legally and politically. But the people of Egypt don't really know what that entails. And so his advisors suggested that he roll out the Sharia very gradually to, you know, don't introduce the cutting off of hands to thieves until about a year into his regime. So even in Muslim majority countries, that, you know, people who are pro Sharia, they haven't really experienced Sharia the way it's, you know, when it's implemented as it's designed to be, the way it was implemented in the Taliban or the way it's implemented now under the Islamic State. They get a taste of that. I dare say most of them would want to leave as quickly as possible.
Does that also explain why, say, places like Saudi Arabia, who are ostensibly our allies, they go to pains to hide from Westerners what Sharia looks like on the street?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I have a lot of, here in Orange County, we have a lot of Iranians, or they like to call themselves Persians, and a lot of Saudis. And it's interesting, the Saudis love it. The Saudi girls love it here because they can get their driver's license and drive around and enjoy all the good things about America. They, they get rid of the hijab or the niqab, whatever they come over with, and they look like Western girls. And the more you get to know them, you ask them what they think of America and what they think of their home country is, they love America and they love Saudi Arabia. And when you start asking precise questions about Saudi Arabia, they get really uncomfortable. Part of it is, they don't want to, that maybe there's a bit of shame about it. Others, another reason is if word gets back to Saudi Arabia, they could be disciplined, or if they're on scholarship, they could be brought back. But the Saudis absolutely conceal the Sharia law that's implemented in their society because it can be so barbaric. But they still abide by it because the masses, by and large, want it.
Dr. Adam Francisco is Associate Professor of History and Political Thought at Concordia University, Irvine, California, author of the book Martin Luther and Islam. You can find out how to pursue an advanced theological study for academic, professional, or personal development with Concordia University, Irvine's Master of Arts in Theology program, where courses are taught online and at intensive on-campus summer sessions. Find out more at cui.edu/theology, cui.edu/theology. Dr. Francisco, thank you very much for being our guest.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
We'll be talking about two issues with Pastor Peter Burfeind on the other side of the break. One of them, irreligious violence on both the left and the right in the United States, and why he thinks it's only going to increase, and how millennials have been driven away from the church by Vacation Bible School. Stay tuned.
If you're like me, you remember when education was about the basic skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic, and about reading great literature and history that gave our kids models of what it is to be a good person. Memoria Press's Classical Christian Curriculum is bringing this kind of education back. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
At Concordia Evangelical Lutheran Church of Wilmington, Delaware, our mission is to serve our community by sharing Christian hope. We've been doing this since 1938 and joyfully continue to do so in the 21st century. If you're ever in the city that DuPont Chemical Corporation calls home, or is known by some as the credit card capital of the world, we hope you visit to receive Jesus through His Word and Sacrament. Otherwise, check us out on the web at ConcordiaWilmington.com.
Essential exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Jesus the good teacher, Jesus the therapist, Jesus the giver of bling. The Issues Etc. book of the month for June is Will the Real Jesus Please Stand Up? 12 False Christs. It's written by regular guest Dr. Matt Richard. Read an excerpt at issuesetc.org or purchase Will the Real Jesus Please Stand Up? By calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. The Issues Etc. book of the month, Will the Real Jesus Please Stand Up?
People are talking about the Lutheran Federal Credit Union. Lutheran FCU was created solely to serve LCMS workers, families, and entities, and proceeds benefit LCMS organizations. Lutheran FCU offers deposit accounts and loans and has service access at thousands of branches and ATMs nationwide. Lutheran FCU also offers members Christian-based lending advice for new loans and refinancing, minimal account fees, and superior personalized service. Check them out at LutheranFCU.org.